Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the Edric Show. I am your host, Edric Jerome. This is the place for intelligent conversation with interesting people. Go ahead and hit that subscribe button, ring that notification bell, leave us a comment, and you'll get notified when I post content each and every week. On today's episode, I continue my discussion around electoral politics here in the United States, and I'm pleased to welcome William Cooper. His new book, How America Works and Why It Doesn't, is a contemporary analysis of the American political system. It aims to explain how the system was originally designed to function and why it's currently experiencing some difficulties. William is an accomplished attorney, a national columnist whose commentaries on American politics have appeared in national publications like the New York Times, the Washington Post, and CNN. William, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Edric. It's great to be here.
It's good to have you. As we were talking about right before we came on, your book is quite timely given the electoral season we are currently in. So let me start out with my first question. What was your personal call to action that led you to write How America Works and Why It Doesn't?
Well, I was practicing law as a relatively junior attorney for a number of years, and felt very insulated, and the world was speeding by past me. Lots of really interesting things were happening, and I was, just working on cases where the facts were 20 years old and the cases were 30 years old, and I felt really, disconnected from society and from what was happening. And at a certain point, I said, okay, I'm just going to change that and start writing, and that's what I did. I first started with columns, and then over time, that turned into writing books, and that's where this book came from. Just a desire to be, a part of the conversation.
Why this book now?
Well, I think, the probably single biggest reason is I think we're still in a period of extreme dysfunction. In my view, it's driven, primarily, although not at all exclusively, but primarily by Donald Trump still being the Republican Party's champion. The reversion to the mean that I've been waiting for years, doesn't seem to be coming. And with an election coming up, it just felt like a good time to try to diagnose really the root cause of why we find ourselves here.
You start out with a deep dive into the origins and the current status of the Constitution. And one of the things I appreciated about your book is you dispel some of the myths about the Constitution on both the left and the right. Can you talk a little bit about a couple of those myths and how those myths have contributed to our current political dysfunction?
Yeah, in my opinion, the Constitution is a document that should be both celebrated and criticized. So it's an irony of history that in the same document, you've got horrible abominations like the Three-Fifths Clause, the Slave Trade Clause. In my opinion, the Second Amendment was very poorly drafted and has had a lot of negative consequences. But at the same time, the basic architecture of our constitutional system, separation of powers, federalism, bicameral legislature, things of that nature, I think have actually been an astounding step forward for humans and have promoted human flourishing in a really dramatic way for several hundred years. And unfortunately, in our politics today, one side will typically criticize the Constitution, want to tear it to shreds, focus on the negatives, the things that are outdated, and there's plenty of examples, without appreciating the positives. And then on the other side, you get triumphalists who think it's, the greatest thing in the world and without any flaws. And if you even mention the flaws, you get swatted away as being cynical. To me, it's both. And it's important to take the whole thing for what it is.
The two-party system and the Electoral College, those structures are bedrock institutions in our current system. Do you think it's time to maybe reevaluate or take a look at the two-party system in terms of how we can maybe break through? And then the other piece of that is the Electoral College. Do you think it's outdated, or are these pillars contributing to our current political environment?
It's a great question. I think the two-party system certainly is not in the Constitution. It's not required. As I mentioned in the book, it's actually something the founders were concerned about, having two juggernauts battling each other. It tends to really promote tribalism and irrationality when you have that. I think a multi-party system with more diverse parties would have a lot of positives. You get more diversity into the debate, into platforms, which I think is incredibly needed. Lots of important ideas just don't get any airtime because one of the two parties don't champion them. It wouldn't solve all problems. I mean, we'd still have social media. We'd still have human nature being what it is. There'd still be challenges. But I think it'd do a lot of good for the polity to have multiple large voices in addition to just the Democrats and the Republicans. I think that would be a real positive. The Electoral College, of course, is in the Constitution. So there's a legitimacy there. In my view, you need to kind of take the Constitution for what it is and not just say, well, the things I like are legitimate. The things I don't like should be repealed, or I'm going to repeal them because I don't like them. But it certainly is outdated. I don't think there's any question about it. I do think, even though I'm not a fan of the Electoral College, I don't think it's needed anymore. And the purpose, you know, of it isn't still there. I do think if you got rid of it, it wouldn't necessarily automatically help the Democrats as much as they think. I think Republicans would change their strategy. Right now, there's huge states with huge populations that they rationally ignore, which tends to make the popular vote go more towards the Democrats. I think if you abolish the Electoral College, you'd see a more strategic effort in some of those large states, California, New York, for example. So it wouldn't necessarily just open up the floodgates for Democratic dominance the way some say it would. It'd be really interesting to see how it plays out, how it would play out, I should say.
Quick follow-up. In most states, the Electoral College votes are winner take all. I think there's like Nebraska, there's some state where there's like a one, I mean, it's a little weird in one of those states. But do you think maybe in terms of the Electoral College, should there be more proportional? I mean, Electoral College votes based on proportionality or something like that? Do you think that might work, or what's your take on that?
Yeah, I think in general, elections should try to be as proportionate as possible. You know, one person, one vote should be the lodestar, and everything should flow from that. You know, it creates really arbitrary results to have these windfalls in one direction or the other. You get Democrats get every single electoral vote in California, even if, you know, there's well over 10 million Republicans in the state. I think the more you can, you know, you can overdo it, and it's not practical to get too granular, but the more you can have that basic principle of one person, one vote, the better.
One of my pet peeves, and be interesting to see how you feel about this, is there's an incessant fixation on polling data in mass media. It contributes, in my opinion, to some of the negativity that we see, because oftentimes the polls are inaccurate, or they paint a false picture of the political sentiment at a given moment. What's your view on maybe, or do you know why there's such a fixation, particularly in the mass media, on polling data? And, you know, just how does that contribute to maybe some of the false expectations that people have? For example, there's going to be a red wave, or there's going to be this and that. And then when it doesn't happen, they go back to scrambling, and people go back to the boards and go, oh, well, we thought this was going to happen, but it didn't. Talk to me about polling data and your view on that.
It's a great point. I think there's a few things at play there. You know, number one, I think much of the media is quite biased in various directions, but any given commentator or reporter is going to have their own biases. They're going to latch on to the facts that they like, and they're going to downplay the facts they don't. Not all of them, but that's human nature in general, and journalists are humans. And you see a lot of that bias. And I think the polling data discussion is often, you get a poll that you know, Fox News or MSNBC like, and that's what they're going to trumpet. So I think that plays a role. I also think there's I'm not an expert in statistical analysis by any means, but I do think there's a lack of kind of basic education and what polling actually means and what probabilities are, versus, you know, if you have a 60% likelihood of winning, that's a 20% increase over your opponent. It's a huge margin of victory expectation. And yet 4 out of 10 times, you're still going to lose.
Right.
And I think people don't always, you know, have, you know, full literacy in what the data means. So I think the combination of those two things creates the mischief that you're talking about. And it's a real problem. It's really unfortunate. Trump, when he won in 2016, there were some unbelievable blunders with the polling data and the prediction, you know, 99.9% likely that Hillary was going to win. It was headlines. Nate Silver, I remember, had it something like 77% likelihood that Hillary would win. And that probably was, you know, more accurate. And it just happened that, look, 7 out of 10 times Hillary would have won, 3 out of 10 Trump would have, and we were in the three, as happens, you know, 30% of the time. So it's a really good point. And yeah, I think it's an area that there's a lot of room for improvement.
You can make the case, or you can argue, that the Supreme Court's ruling in Citizens United v. FCC in 2011 fundamentally changed electoral politics in our country. Why was this ruling so important? And what are some of the destructive consequences of that ruling?
Well, it was an enormously consequential decision and very counterintuitive to me and to most people. I think that you would conclude that money is speech. I mean, nobody thinks of their handing a $20 bill at the cash register, you know, as speaking. And even some of the justices that tend to be more rational, you know, got on board with that that view. And it's opened the floodgates to, you know, for money to pour in from, you know, deep pockets, of course. I think it's a problem for me, and it's not something I've studied deeply, but for me, it's hard for me to figure out exactly how to measure the problem. Because I know some candidates that have less money still win. I know sometimes small donors and online campaigning can be really influential. So my sense is it's a problem, that the decision was a mistake, but I do have trouble measuring it and kind of sorting through exactly what it means.
Because in my view, I think one of the things that troubles me is sometimes there is an anonymity to some of these donations, to where you don't know where the money's coming from. And if you don't know where the money's coming from, it's kind of hard to pin down that particular candidate on whose interest they are actually representing. Would you agree with that?
Yes. Yep. I think the lack of transparency is a problem. I mean, kind of going back to what I said a few minutes ago, the basic framework for an election in terms of tallying the votes should be one person, one vote. I think the basic framework for an election in terms of the process of the campaigning should be all the information that's relevant is on the table. And that includes the candidate's statements, their past history and record in government or the private sector. It also includes where the money's coming from. So voters should be fully informed. They should have all the information out there, including donors and who they are and how much. And then when they take all that information and they walk to the polls, their vote counts proportionate to their fellow citizens. I mean, that's a basic framework that shouldn't be controversial, but unfortunately, it's not something that we have here in the United States.
Yeah, and not to belabor the point, but I have a wild idea that any national elected official who appears on, you know, CNN, Fox, whatever, they should have to list the top three donors in their last filing or something like that.
I think that's a great idea.
Like race car drivers, you know, race car drivers, they have all the different, I mean, I think there should be some accountability on at least letting us know, you know, who the top three donors in your campaign. But
totally agree. And you learn, yeah, and you learn so much from donors, because you know, people can get on TV and say things, you know, people can huff and puff and bloviate, and you can, you know, hand out flyers all day long. But if you see a very sophisticated organization funneling a lot of money to a candidate, you know there's some real signal there. You know the reason they're doing that is because they anticipate, typically for valid reasons, that that candidate is going to support them. So you get a lot, you would get a lot of signal in that data in terms of projecting out in the future what a candidate might do.
You write about Congress and some of the failures that are currently happening in Congress in terms of policy that's needed. Give me your take on Congress now and maybe some of the ways that maybe some changes can happen. Why is there so much dysfunction? And, you know, this notion of performative politics, which we see now, which is not legislative politics, but people are there to perform for cameras. So talk to me about your take on Congress right now and just the malaise that we see up there in Washington from our congressional situation.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're always going to have a mixture in Congress of, I think, performative politicians, that's a great way to put it, and real government officials who are there to get things done and to legislate. It's always going to be a mix. I think what we've seen in the 21st century, driven in large part by the media, social media, and the sort of the echo chambers there, there's a lot of people are there. They're more focused on their next Instagram post than they are on passing legislation. You know, huge, huge challenges for our country that are going unaddressed. You know, criminal justice deficiencies, the environment, you know, excessive inequality. These really big problems. I think a huge swath of Congress people don't care. They're there to see their name in the paper. They're there to increase their Instagram followers. They're there to win the next election so they can keep increasing their Instagram followers. And it's really unfortunate, and it results in a lot of what we're seeing. I mean, we have these huge problems. Healthcare is another example, I think, of a big problem. Immigration, where a rational polity would be doing a much better job with this. And I think one of the key drivers of that is exactly what you brought up. People who are more focused on being celebrities than getting things done.
Now, having written the book and now that it's out there, what do you want people to take away after reading it? And if you had to pick one area or maybe a couple of areas where you think the priority should be in terms of maybe making effective change. Obviously, this system, this large, is not going to change overnight. But what do you want people to take away? And what's a potential area where people can maybe get involved and help make change?
Yeah. So, you know, I know that I'm not going to change hearts and minds with one book on a grand scale. It's just not going to happen. But if I can get people to just think about things a little bit from the perspective I offer, I think that would be great. And one real overarching theme of the book is that partisanship is not a good thing. A citizen should try to be accurate with their views, right? If you're a politician or you're a paid political operative, you have incentives to spew narratives in favor of your constituency or your donors. But if you're a citizen, your objective should be to be accurate. I mean, what other purpose is there as a citizen consuming news and consuming information about the government than to try to make sense of it accurately? And so if people can steer more towards that direction and less towards just being a member of a party or a member of a tribe, I think that would go a long way to, you know, getting people in government, right? Getting voters to vote for officials who are in a similar vein, who aren't worried about their Instagram posts, but want to get things done, want to look past partisanship and say, look, this is a huge problem. I don't care if I'm a Democrat or I'm a Republican. This is a big problem. Here's some things we can do to address it. And the more energy we can get in that direction, the better. And so if there's one takeaway from the book, it's that we just need more of that. We need more practical people rolling up their sleeves, swatting away all of the false narratives and just saying, let's get things done, and not worrying about where on the political aisle that happens to fall.
Well said. Well said. Well, William, if people want more information about you or they want to pick up a copy of the book, where can they go?
So the book's very easy to find online. You can just Google it. It's on Amazon, of course, and all the major retailers, How America Works and Why It Doesn't. And I have a website, will-cooper.com. So will-cooper.com. Those are two easy ways to find me.
Excellent. Well, William, congratulations on the book. As I mentioned in the opening, it's quite timely. And I really appreciate the practical approach you took with this book, and it's balanced and fair. And I think people will come away with hopefully a sense of maybe there is some commonality out there among us to where we can demand some of these changes that's needed in our electoral process. So, William, thank you for coming on the Edric Show.
Thank you, Edric. You have a great show. A real privilege to be on it. So thank you.
You're very welcome. You're very welcome. This has been another edition of the Edric Show. My guest has been William Cooper, author of the new book, How America Works and Why It Doesn't. As promised, this is the place for intelligent conversation with interesting people. Go ahead and hit that subscribe button, ring that notification bell, leave us a comment, and you'll get notified when I post content each and every week. I am your host, Edric Jerome. I want to thank you for tuning in, and I will catch you on the next episode.